Scientific evidence is mounting that cars are killing us in many ways. We know vehicle exhaust fills our lungs with toxic byproducts. These invade even in the womb, deforming DNA and setting up children for all kinds of childhood diseases, such as asthma and cancer, and possibly even autism. Our addiction to oil has fueled wars, terrorism, and unrest in far-flung corners of the world, and may be dictating a militarized society. Meanwhile, the urban sprawl and parking lots of car land have demolished much of our best agricultural pieces. But the largest and possibly fatal challenge is the amount of greenhouse gases pouring out of our tailpipes. The answer is simple, isn't it? We just need to get away from the oil-based car culture. But how likely is that? Professor Matthew Patterson argues that cars are deeply embedded in our self-image, our culture, our economy, and our politics. In a speech given at the Vancouver Institute on April 14, 2007, this internationally recognized expert on transportation and the environment spoke on moving the earth, car culture, and global environmental policies. This is Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. Do cars serve us, or the interests of an authoritarian elite? Returning to the late Middle Ages, the period before fossil fuel transportation, Professor Patterson explains how mobility brought more personal freedom, but also war and concentration of wealth. Listening to this, I hear almost a neo-Marxian version of how capitalists used mobility to accumulate wealth and then capture political power. This seems obvious from the early days of railroad barons, followed by oil magnates like John D. Rockefeller, and owners of big car companies, all of whom had immediate contacts with presidents and prime ministers. In many cases, the transportation elite provided the secretaries of state, the top bureaucrats, and even governors and vice presidents. This is why a solution to climate change and other pollution problems caused by car culture is first of all political, and underlying that, economic. After all, the two largest industries in the world today may be vehicle production and the oil to fuel them. We can't dismantle them overnight without retreating from civilization as we know it, and without a revolution in politics. This whole system of power and production, Patterson says, becomes deeply embedded in the individual, through us, generally through advertising images. We express ourselves by what we drive. Let's listen for a minute.
If you like, cars have become deeply embedded in who it is to be us. The cars we drive, the cars we don't drive, our particular relationships to them say a lot about who we did, what sorts of people we are. It is not too much to say, I think, and this is certainly the claim of the book that are coming out and a number of other people who work in this area, that to be a modern person is fundamentally to be mobile, to be moving around, and who we are is defined by where we've been, how we can get about, and it's associated fundamentally with our freedom. We associate, or many of us associate, our freedom with our ability to move around at will without constraints. Conversely, to be insistently not a car driver is frequently to attract attention, even ridicule. Margaret Thatcher, in the country where I grew up, said famously in the mid-1980s that any man, and it's probably specifically a man, who finds himself still on a bus at the age of 30 should count himself as a failure. A failure in life, I think she said specifically. Now, whatever we think of Margaret Thatcher is one thing, but it shows very clearly that being in a car is what is regarded frequently as being a normal person in the societies we live in. Any of the cyclists in the room will be able to tell you, boy is stupid, with tales of being shouted at by car drivers and regarded as sort of somehow deviant. The extremes are maybe the famous stories of, or the extreme cases in, say, Southern California, where people have been known to be arrested for being pedestrians in the wrong place. Just for the act of walking is regarded as suspicious, or grounds for suspicion. Now, one of the most obvious sites, so the question is that one question I think we have to ask is, why has it become the case that we've become so attached to our cars? And why have cars become part of the definition of who it is to be us?
Matthew Patterson has just completed three books on car culture, aimed at both professional and popular audiences. Here is a description of them given in the introduction to his speech at the Vancouver Institute.
The first is an edited volume, edited with Professor Graham Smith, on environmental politics, published by Routledge. This explores how, over recent years, environmental politics has moved from a peripheral interest to a central concern within the discipline of politics. The second work, again an edited volume by Professor Patterson and three co-editors, called Against Automobility, published by Blackwell, is a critical account of the impact of the automobile on society, which is both liberated by and reliant upon motor vehicles, and looks at the way the car shapes and the car's role is shaped by our social relationships and our institutions. And then thirdly, Dr. Patterson has published a book, Automobile Politics, published again in 2006 by the Cambridge University Press, that examines the political forces that have made cars so dominant in our lives and looks at how the political and social institutions that sustain this dominance operate to shape our attempts to do something about the car's environmental role.
As Patterson examines different advertising images, he is struck by their invitation to become part of the ruling elite. Cadillac comes right out and says their vehicle speaks of ruling the world. The late Rover Company demonstrates their cars ruling the wilds of Africa exactly as the British did in their days of empire. As he says, the powerful drive, while losers and slobs ride the bus or bicycles, that's the image we were given. These multi-billion-dollar advertising campaigns are one of the barriers to changing our carbon pollution and thus saving the climate. When you watch television news or flip through the pages of major newspapers, it becomes clear that all of our information about the world is paid for and mediated by car manufacturing companies and the oil companies hiding behind that industry. And now, car makers are using our love of nature and even our concern about climate change as a way to sell everything from SUVs to hybrids, more cars as a solution for the environment. Cars, trains, and planes are almost synonymous with freedom in our minds, the freedom to travel. In the following clip from his speech, Patterson gives us quite a different take. Governments used to be hostile to travel as a means to secure their power. Now, they depend upon us being detached from the land and location to maintain economic power.
If you look at the history, this will be a Eurocentric history, or European societies from the 17th century onwards, what governors wanted to do, by and large at that point, in general, making big generalisations, was prevent people from moving around. You had all sorts of road tolls, all sorts of barriers, taxes, etc., etc., limiting, principally aimed at limiting people's movement. Governors, monarchs, saw people moving around as a dangerous thing. It's where sedition could rise. It's where, you know, threats of rebellion could be instigated and so on. So they attempted fundamentally to prevent movement. But with the development of the European state system, increasingly governors needed people also to move around more actively, whether that's for military reasons, to be able to fight more effective warfare, whether that's to develop economic production to be the basis of warfare, and for a variety of reasons, monarchs in France and England and et cetera, created means to try and get people moving more around. To control that movement, certainly, because they didn't want to have too much sedition and rebellion, but they wanted to channel it. But it's all, so there's always this tension between trying to control the movement but also accelerate it. The apogee in the 18th century is with the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, where you have the levée en masse, which is a sort of where the revolutionary forces are fundamentally directed towards accelerating the way that people move around, channeling the way that people move around in order to fight warfare more effectively. In the 19th century, it then moves. What you then get is a period of that gets transformed from being just getting people to move around more effectively to increase production, etc., to accelerating those movements. And that's the point. It's, the 19th century is when large numbers of people suddenly can move faster than they can walk, with the development in particular of the train. And you get a whole series of social changes consequent on that in terms of how people relate to space differently. people suddenly have much greater distances between where they live and where they work. They have maybe have start to have greater distances between themselves and the rest of their family. And where mobility starts to become a central part of how they're organised on a daily basis, or certainly much more common than was previously the case. You get the emergence during the 19th century of modern concepts like we have of leisure, where leisure and travel become quite closely related. There is still, however, the tension is that in the dangers of movement, the emergence of rebellions, the emergence of workers' movements is fundamentally to do with their capacity to move and to coordinate their action, for example, which is made more possible with this increased mobility. You could have people suddenly going around in trains stirring up activism for this or that cause. But at the same time, governors need us to move around more to increase production, etc., etc. There's a tension for the governors. There's also increasingly a tension for people moving around. On the one hand, in the French Revolution, for example, freedom of movement was a fundamental part of the political, was the demands that were made by the revolutionaries. But very quickly, with the levée en masse, that experiences what some people call a dictatorship of movement. That people started in 1789 with freedom of movement as a demand, and suddenly they found they were being forced to move out all the way around Europe with Napoleonic armies within a matter of 6 or 7 years. And this, throughout the 19th century, this tension between movement, mobility holding out some promise of a better job or of a nicer place to live or whatever it might be, but at the same time suddenly becoming this thing, I've got to get up because the train's going. You become determined by by having to move around for work or whatever other reason. So you get that, those two types of tension created by societies becoming more and more organised around mobility. So the point that I want to make then is that the world that we now live into of assuming to be mobile on a daily basis, that to assume that it's normal to move around over very large distances on a daily basis, to have ties all over the world, and increasingly perhaps less ties to any particular place in the world, to get our needs met across the planet in terms of food and housing and whatever, and to have a certain way of sort of being almost restless, almost nomadic, is the result of not of some natural thing that it's just natural for us to want to be like that, but that we've become like that in part because governors have wanted us to become mobile. It's very useful for how the world that we live in, for us to want to move. If we want to move around and we think of that as part of our freedom, that's actually very good for the economic system and the political system that we also live in.
The First World War, some historians have suggested, was caused partly by train transportation. Troops could be mobilized and moved rapidly, but only along existing lines and according to fixed schedules. In the 1920s, the rigidity of trains gave way to the automobile and trucks. Henry Ford developed the assembly line method of production, which then spread to all kinds of manufacturing, thus leading to the mass consumer culture that is now consuming Earth's resources at record rates. History, says Matthew Patterson, cannot be disconnected from our transportation system. That seems a key lesson, as we now struggle to modify our whole economic system to prevent catastrophic climate change.
Cars actually more broadly remain absolutely central to the economy. In North America, you still routinely get a figure trotted out that 1 in 7 people employed or associated with the car industry, less in Europe, but nevertheless a very high number of people whose employment depends on the car industry directly or indirectly. The pattern of urban development is still fundamentally organised around assumptions of car ownership and an expansion in car use, and this despite all sorts of ideas about smart growth or relatively small increases in public money going to public transport over the last 10-15 years. Transport spending is still vastly disproportionately on the car, for example. So cars are still central to capitalism.
But the promise of cars can be used for militarism and control as well. Consider Hitler's promise with the Volkswagen.
So those two above forces, the cultural power of cars, or how they become powerful, and the way that we associate a whole set of important symbols with them, and the way that cars have been central to the way that the economy has been organised, in the 20th century are the central reasons for me that we live in a car-dominated world. They underlie the sort of routine planning decisions that people make about where to put this or this housing development, where to allow a supermarket to be built, etc., etc. Governors have been able to use the way that cars can be understood as giving us freedom of movement for their own purposes, military, economic, and so on. Hitler famously developed the Volksmobil. Precisely, it was very explicit about it being the people's car, and it was going to give all Germans the freedom of car use and so on. Volksmobil, what became the bug here or the beetle in Europe, was sold to a civilian before the war at all. It was all designed for military production, but using these symbols of that freedom and nationalism and so on in that case. So they've been able to use this power, this symbolic power of the freedom of movement, to pursue their legitimacy, and that's been one of the reasons why we've become so attached to our cars. Not the only, but one of them.
In the next piece, Patterson describes how car makers have fought against various pollution controls for decades, stalling improvements needed for health and the environment. He says they make lousy allies for the climate change movement. Other sectors of the economy are coming on board, and the climate change movement is becoming more acceptable in the business community because the financial system sees new ways to make money out of it, through carbon trading, for example.
There is a need to articulate any policy with it to try and green automobility with the interests of at least a substantial part of that big business, that capital. If we look, for example, at the history of air pollution policy, this shows very clearly that the capacity of oil companies and car companies to slow and resist proposals for reform. All of the substantial proposals from the early 50s onwards in California and then elsewhere in North America and Europe and East Asia, through getting rid of lead in petrol, through development of catalytic converters, through the fuel economy standards, through fuel taxation measures, through action to deal with climate change, etc., have all been resisted, mostly successfully, by car companies, successfully in the sense that they've slowed down progress very substantially. And that suggests either, to my mind, the need to look for other allies. Car manufacturers are not the only firms in the world, in terms of at least of their economic size, they're in relative decline compared to, say, information technology sectors or one or two others. There's a need to look for other allies that can counterbalance the power of coal and oil firms. If we look at climate policy, for example, as one example of this, the reason that climate policy, in my view, has become tremendously successful, whether it's successful in reducing greenhouse gas emissions is another question, but successful in terms of getting what policymakers call traction in terms of developing the policy, is because they've been designed... They've managed to design a policy in terms of, or a set of policies in terms of emissions trading and a whole set of other measures, where financiers, the financial markets, have suddenly decided that climate policy is in their interests, and so they've become quite supportive of climate policy. And so that's an example where coal and oil firms were lobbying very heavily against the Kyoto Protocol, against other measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And they've been able to be sidelined politically because policymakers have been able to go to the city effectively and design policies where lots of city finances through emissions trading programs and so on can make lots of money and therefore support the policy and enabling the sidelining of car manufacturers.
As a person who prefers bicycles and other modes of travel, Patterson looks at the weaknesses in the car industry that may push change. For one thing, the classic alliance between car companies and the oil industry may be weakening. Even internationalism may stimulate more positive regulations rather than the decline in standards we usually expect.
And secondly, I think there's a sense of using chinks in the car, the car block's armour. If you look at the California legislation, which started in the early 1990s, to mandate what they call zero emissions from a certain... So the mandate that car manufacturers produce a certain proportion of their cars for sale in the California market is what they call zero emissions. And then the idea is that percentage of cars on the market would have to rise over time. One of the things that did was split the car companies from the oil companies. One of the things it sort of did was made the car companies realise that with all, even though they dragged their feet for 40 years, the vast majority of the costs that have been incurred in responding to environmental regulation have been borne by the car companies, not the oil companies. All the oil companies had to do was take lead out of petrol, which didn't really bother them that much, compared to the sort of costs that car manufacturers had undertaken over the years. So there's the ways of opening up the interest of, if you like, divide and rule between the sorts of other companies that car manufacturers are often associated with. There's also sometimes possibilities in internationalisation. So, for example, one of the reasons that that catalytic converters were mandated in Europe at the point they were was because German manufacturers were competing fiercely with the then dying British car, well, still dying British car industry, over the choice of technology. Thatcher, following the British car industry, was favouring what were called lean burn engines. The Germans favoured catalytic converters. So in that case, the diplomatic fight in the European context favoured actually getting something done, because it's usually people think about internationalisation of being, well, we can't act because our competitors abroad are going to have a cheaper ride. You know, that's a standard argument in Canada, for example, about climate change. If we act and the Americans don't, you know, it'll be, our business will be disadvantaged. In that sort of, in some instances, however, you can design your strategies to where you can use your own business, you can favour your own businesses while pursuing more aggressive measures.
Because capitalism is built on the necessity of constant growth, Patterson suggests a plan based on ever-growing limitations will not be accepted by the business world. Instead, he and others suggest a new strategy called smart growth. The vision encompasses whole new industries in sustainable energy and emissionless cars, plus financial markets based on carbon reductions. If we ask people about their cars, most associate them with freedom, yet, as technology and green guilt build up, the car is actually becoming a tool of surveillance and control, Patterson explains.
In terms of thinking about the environmental component of cars, the cultural, as much as the economic, has shifted it towards the more reform version, shifted it towards trying to get people to drive slightly greener cars rather than to reorganise their lives around it. It's promoting alternatives to the car. And, you know, tellingly, I think here it's the move to the suburbs, have a couple of kids, start an RESP. I mean, that's the ideology of what it is, what a normal person does, that's underpinning how that's understood. There's a contradiction here, though, in terms of the cultural power of cars. One of the things is that if you look at the environmental regulation that has been happened, because people are so attached to their cars, but because people at the same time are quite ambivalent and worried about environmental pollution, worried about congestion, worried about threats to their own neighbourhoods, etc., etc., what you've had is progressively over a long period of time is actually more and more intrusion in our daily lives. If you drive a car now, you're much more just sort of surveyed on a daily basis, almost, in terms of, you know, with CCTV quite frequently in urban traffic situations, with a whole set of inspection maintenance regimes on the car where you go every year and you have to get your drive clean tests or whatever it might be. The systems vary in different jurisdictions. But whereas car drivers, you're actually surveyed. And now with GPS, I mean, GPS is talked about as, you know, OnStar, for example, the GM system is talked about how, you know, it's going to enable them to get you if you've broken down and you're in the middle of nowhere. But it also enables the state to know where you are at any one time. If they need to find you, they can find you. And some countries have now started to talk about using GPS as automated fines to generate automated fines for speeding. They can tell you for speeding if they want to. Technologically, that's already possible. And, you know, given a whole set of pressures, so as we become more and more attached to our cars, but we also worry about all the consequences of us all using cars, that means actually we become more and more surveyed as we car, as we use our cars. And with the possible thing, of course, with the consequence that it attenuates the idea that we're free as a car driver. On the one hand, we're being surveyed. On the other hand, a lot of the technologies to try and green car driving, the logical outcome of them is that they will abolish the driver. We'll all be driving around in automated cars, where we won't be a driver in any serious sense. We'll just say, I want to go, you know, we talk to the car and say, I want to go to work today, please, and it will take you to work. And it's all based on a smart highway where you can drive, because everything's automated, you can drive a yard and a half away from the car front
car in front of you so that there's no congestion, etc., etc., etc.
But then what's the freedom of being in a car if you're not driving it? So there's a cultural contradiction there that cars are associated with freedom, but actually because we're so attached to them, we become less free as we drive because we're being more surveyed, etc., etc.
Perhaps to our dismay, Matthew Patterson doesn't offer any neat solutions to the car dilemma at the end of his speech. His mission has been to point out how complex and deeply embedded cars have become in our culture, our economy, and our system of political control. In the question period, Patterson suggests the current trend of retro cars, like the PT Cruiser or the revived Mustang, represent a denial of the real problems in car culture.
Is I think the nostalgia that fits within the same thing. There's a nostalgia for a past, and one of the nostalgia amongst car buffs and car firms, like if you think of Chrysler, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have all the problems we have now? We don't have to deal with all this environmental regulation. We don't have to deal with all these people slagging us off for being so hot, you know, useless on X, Y, and Z. Wouldn't it be nice if we can go back to the golden age?
Yet his research doesn't show health as a primary motivation to change our dependence on cars. All of the concerns, from high fatalities in accidents to smog killing people, have been known and tolerated for half a century. Health-related improvements come very slowly after decades of struggle, not quickly enough to prevent rapid global warming. Answering another question, Patterson's inside sources tell him the fuel cell is the engine of the near future, not 20 or 30 years from now, but going on sale commercially around 2012. Fuel cells are far more efficient than gasoline engines or diesels, but the unanswered question is, where does the massive amount of electricity required to split hydrogen from water come from? If the source is coal, we're cooked. If it's nuclear, we risk radiating the planet. Despite these gaps, he thinks the hydrogen-powered fuel cell will replace the internal combustion engine in our lifetimes. You can hear all this discussion in the question and answer period, which is available for download, along with the full speech, at the Radio EcoShock website. Go to www.ecoshock.org and look for transportation in the Audio On Demand menu. You can contact Professor Patterson at the School of Political Studies, University of Ottawa, Canada. I'm Alex Smith, and thanks for listening.